All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Nothing can illustrate these observations more forcibly than a recollection of the happy conjuncture of times and circumstances under which our republic assumed its rank among the nations. The foundation of our empire was not laid in the gloomy age of ignorance and superstition, but at an epoch, when the rights of mankind were better understood and more clearly defined than at any former period. The researches of the human mind after social happiness have been carried to a great extent. The treasures of knowledge acquiring by the labors of philosophers, sages, and legislators through a long succession of years are laid open for our use, and their collected wisdom may be happily applied in the establishment of our forms of government. The free cultivation of letters, the unbound extension of commerce, the progressive refinement of manners, the growing liberality of sentiment have had a ameliorating influence on mankind and increase the blessings of society. At this auspicious period, the United States came into existence as a nation. And if their citizens should not be completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own. That was George Washington, June 8th, 1783. Welcome, friends, to this evening show of American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. I spent all day and all night thinking about how I can make this week's topic a little better, and I prayed about it, and I thought, you know, what better way to go back into time and history to get the viewpoint of Americans of what it meant to them to be an American and what risk would come upon them for trying to become their own nation. And who better to help us tell that story tonight than the first president of the United States, George Washington. Now, I've got 4 pages of notes and about 8 different tabs pulled up on my computer. I've had a lot of reading material for probably the last, 4 to 6 hours worth. And I will tell you that I don't have enough time within 1 hour to tell you about the greatness of George Washington or about his failings. George Washington was a humble man from humble beginnings. He lost his father at an early age. At 16, he became a very ambitious lad. He went on his first expedition as a surveyor out on the frontier. And from there, his career began to grow and grow in multitudes, which started off with an early military career. And, he blundered his way along that, and he made many mistakes as a young man, an impatient, ambitious, maybe overly confident young man. And through the years of, military temperance, battles, building up his own leadership style, witnessing how the British did it and the things that he didn't like about it, because the British were not, they were not exactly fans of the colonials. the interactions that he had during the French and Indian War and with politics along the way, his expanding reach of the frontier westward throughout the Ohio River Valley, experiences that he had with various Native American tribes that were on the Iroquois Confederacy. He learned quite a bit, and he learned many different tactics that the military takes and uses today. And many of his quotes are still used, still read to young recruits at basic training for all the branches, I hope still. And I think he is the figurehead of what it means to be an American. He had such a tenacity and such a indomitable will that he just refused to quit. And he was beat many times. The British embarrassed him several times on the battlefield, forced him to flee. But every time this man was forced off the field, he learned. He reviewed internally his failings. He reviewed outwardly the failings of his men and his tactics, the logistics that were not applied properly during these times of battle or during the troop movements. And he learned how to take something that was almost utterly destroyed, being the colonials, colonial army, and he wielded it like a sword that had one last chance to swing. And he eventually helped to defeat the British and their rule of tyranny over the United States. Thus, we very soon won our independence. But the American Revolutionary War, which is something we're going to talk about next week, it has so many different angles of approach for this. Politics played a huge role in it. And I'm going to give you some history of things that led up to the American Revolutionary War, something that led up to what the colonials at that point in time, who were, you know, they were loyal to the crown, but they were still American colonists, their points of view, why they chose potentially to betray the crown and to become their own country, and the turmoils that went with that. The lives lost, the industries lost, the respect lost, families separated. War does a lot of ugly things. But the one thing war always does is it exposes the truth about people. And it exposes the inner turmoils that people go through. Because once push comes to shove and you back somebody into a corner, people will show you that there's two ways out. They can capitulate and cower down, or they will fight tooth and nail to get out of the corner. America did not have much of a choice if it wanted to become an empire, if it wanted to become its own nation, a successful nation, without the authoritative rule from Great Britain. They knew they had to eventually take the risk. And, you know, for dozens and dozens of years, this war was coming. People eventually knew that British rule over the American colonies were not going to last. And the rumors were being stirred up amongst the people anyways, taxation without representation being one of them. We see all these things happening in history, and I'm going to read to you some of the notes that I have down, over 4 pages worth of notes. And you're going to hear some correlations from the mid-1700s that may sound like it can still apply in a post-apocalyptic America, or at least the current state that we're in right now. I want you to consider, as I read these writings to you, and as I go over some material that I have sourced from the whitehouse.gov and a couple other different sources, and I'll give you all the sources and just let you know I'm not plagiarizing anybody here. Great material, and you know, I just wish I had the time to sit down and go to all these different places and write about all this great history, but thank God someone else already has. But I implore you to walk the footsteps of our founding fathers at least once in your life. You know, people, when they go on vacation, they want to go and be entertained. They want to go to Las Vegas. They want to go to the Grand Canyon. They want to go to Tahiti. They want to go to Maui. They want to go and just relax. Well, before you pass on into eternity, take one working vacation and go visit the places where our founding fathers first met, where they decided to fight tyranny, to become a nation, to try this new American experiment, and enlighten yourself, enlighten your children. There's some great quotes from George Washington, and I strongly suggest people, you know, read some of George Washington's quotes. They're at times very inspirational, and at times a lot of forethought went into this man. And it's amazing how from the late 1700s, so many things still apply today. So I'm going to read to you some of his quotes before we get started. I'm a huge fan of quotes. One day when this godforsaken website gets put up, I'll have all these great quotes on there for your inspirational purposes. But for right now, let's hear a little bit about George Washington and what he thought, and the things that he thought helped to make a better American. It is better to offer no excuse than a bad one. Try applying that one in your life, ladies and gentlemen. It is better to be alone than in bad company. If freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. Someone needs to tell our legislators that one. A primary object should be the education of our youth in the science of government. In a republic, what species of knowledge can be equally important, and what duty more pressing than communicating it to those who are to be the future guardians of the liberties of the country? Wow. Once again, another student of history, another fan of history. Please teach history to our children before it is lost, ladies and gentlemen. A free people ought not only to be armed, but disciplined, to which end a uniform and well-digested plan is required, and their safety and interest require that they should promote such manufactories as tend to render them independent of others for essential, particularly military, supplies. So, once again, a little forethought there for those who are going to find themselves in the post-apocalyptic America. Don't just think about growing your gardens. Think about growing your security and your elements to supply that security. Every single settlement, once this country eventually gets taken down, will have to supply its own military or militia. Make sure it's well logistically taken care of. In politics as in philosophy, my tenets are few and simple. The leading of one of which, and indeed that which embraces most others, is to be honest and just ourselves, and to exact it from others, meddling as little as possible in their affairs where our own are not involved. If this maxim was generally adopted, wars would cease, and our swords would soon be converted into reap hooks, and our harvests be more peaceful, abundant, and happy. George Washington also said that human happiness is moral duty, or human happiness and moral duty are inseparably connected. I mean, that's true. When people are unhappy and miserable and they don't think other humans should deserve the same, they will do horrific things to their fellow man. I have seen it. I have seen it done. However, George also tells us, however, political parties may now and then answer popular ends, they are likely in the course of time and things to become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which they have lifted to unjust dominion. So what does he say, basically? Corrupt politicians ruin the country. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Be careful who you vote. We're going to go to a break, and we're going to get into this. I'll see you right back after this quick message.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
Welcome back. This is American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. We are expounding upon tonight our first president, one of the greatest generals America ever had, George Washington. Now, I was reading some quotes from old George, and I'd like to throw another one in there. Guard against the imposters of pretended patriotism. I'm looking at you, politicians. All you politicians who wear the American flag and you scream about patriotism and how we need to protect our country. It's interesting how all you same patriots then gathered yourselves together for the January 6th Commission. No one cared about the meddlings of the election. Nobody cares about the vaxation without representation. God, I hope I can get that stick. I'm going to make a sticker out of that one. Nobody cares about how these same politicians come up with a new excuse every fiscal year to take away your Second Amendment right and then to eventually snuff out the candle of your First Amendment right, effectively not making us Americans anymore. That's the two things that separates us from everything else. Your right to bear arms and your right to the freedom of speech. You know, Teddy Roosevelt said, don't hit at all if it is honorably possible to avoid hitting, but never hit soft. And this is the mindset that I have when I come to you with information. When I come to we the people to present a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of insight from my years in the government and in law enforcement and the military, and just my own personal beliefs, I'm not going to hold any punches. I'm going to tell you how it is. I hope I don't greatly offend you. But at the same point, I don't say anything that is overtly offensive. I don't say anything that, honestly, I don't find to be subjectively wrong. I think if you find yourself being offended by anything I've said, if I've talked about people being grossly overweight in this country, or extremely ignorant and unprepared, then maybe you should reevaluate the rest of the world. Maybe you should reevaluate yourself and take a glance back into history, because we don't live in this will never happen to me land. History is real and it repeats itself. And the world keeps doing it. And politicians keep betraying us. Evil people keep killing each other. Natural disasters keep trying to kill us. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not live in a fairyland where everything just sparkles and you float around like a butterfly. That's not reality. I'm not going to tell you whimsical dreams and fairy tales. That's not what this platform is for. I want to get back to the meat that is what Americans should be concerning themselves over. It's the same thing that Americans have been concerning themselves over since before it was America. How to take care of yourself, how to be independent. Speak your mind, stand upon your principles firmly. Do not ever back down. Do not ever let yourself be bullied. And remember this, you're not alone in this fight. You have people like me who are advocates for you. Even if I've never met you and I don't know you, I will always defend my brother and sister. I will always, and I have always, stuck my neck out for the American dream. We are the only thing that's worth dreaming about anymore in this country, but in this world. Americans are not escaping to go to Mexico unless you're a felon. Americans are not escaping America to go to Great Britain so that they can have their scissors taken from them, because there's an epidemic of scissors and knife attacks throughout Europe. That's what happens after you take all the guns away from the people. Americans are not fleeing to Australia to lock themselves up in COVID camps for months until the government decides you've been a good little boy or girl and you can be let out now. I don't see Americans escaping to Syria or Kuwait. No one is selling off everything they own and starting a new pilgrimage to Afghanistan, are they? No, all those people from around the world, they're trying to get here. They are willing to discover the American dream. They're willing to learn the history, because when you go through immigrations, you have to learn the history. You get tested upon it, if you did not know that. You actually get tested upon your knowledge of American history. Now, whether or not you continue to pursue that knowledge is up to you, and I would hope that if you are a recent immigrant to this country, you do continue to pursue that knowledge. I don't suggest you forget who you are or where you come from, but you're an American. Be American. You know, if you wanted to stay in your country, then go back to it. If you want to flee this country for whatever reason, by all means, leave. Antarctica is always waiting for the next movement, the next migration of people. But while we're in America, let's remember how to be Americans. Maybe that can stop a lot of this pettiness. So, I have climbed upon my soapbox. I'm going to climb back down, and I'm going to get back into what we were originally talking about, which is history. Tonight's topic, George Washington. So just a a little bit of a heads up. I haven't wrote down everything that there is out there about George Washington. If anything, I have just barely scraped his military career. And I mean the beginnings of it, but I find it to be very interesting. I think people don't understand who this man was and what shaped him to be the way he was. And I think it's very important because a lot of it leads up to why America became a revolting, rebellious group of people in the beginning. And George Washington had a huge, huge hand in it, and he never knew it. Not until later. George Washington, born in Pope's Creek, Virginia, in 1732. He lost his father at about 11 years old, was raised by his mother. He has several brothers and sisters and half-brothers and half-sisters. He never had a formal education like many of his counterparts that he would later serve with throughout, you know, the British military or the American colonies. Many of these men that he ended up serving with were, you know, very astute people who were philosophers, who were very successful businessmen, or people who had royalty ties and who were very wealthy, very well connected. These are the men who helped develop America, after all. But George had a very humble beginning. His family were planters, mainly tobacco. Before George died, he ended up accumulating up to 577 slaves. Like I said on this show before, I'm not going to hold any punches. I'm going to tell you the good and the bad. By the time he was 11, he had inherited hundreds of slaves. He had inherited a huge plantation and a lot of responsibility for a young man. While well-established young men in Washington's era were going to college, Washington went to war. He became a surveyor at the age of 16 and accompanied George William Fairfax on a surveying expedition through the western frontier of Virginia. Now, the frontier, once again, we're talking about frontiersmen. The frontier is a unknown, unregulated, undesignated territory that Western expansion from the American colonies, these expansions were typically led by governors of these colonies and were backed by very wealthy people like the Ohio Company, which were more or less going out on expeditions, surveying land, and then land-buying companies would come in and purchase these lands through deeds. And that's how all these people ended up getting paid. And you'll discover later why that ends up being so important to our story. The following year, he was appointed as the county surveyor for the newly established frontier county of Culpeper. And that's at the age of 17. Washington had gained a respectable profession, and over the course of 50 years, he completed numerous surveys. Many of these surveys documented the expanding territory along the western frontier of Virginia, and he became very knowledgeable of the land, of the various Native American tribes that inhabited them, the backwaters, the rivers, the streams, the various different types of plants that were edible. The different types of trees that were out there. And, you know, for these surveyors, when they would go out, it's not just measuring distances. They're gathering all sorts of intelligence, all sorts of data. You know, it's just something that you're going out and you're surveying these lands and you're saying, look, this square plot of land, no matter how big it would be, how many acres, would contain one water source or two water sources or a large stream or river. It would be rocky or mountainous, which, you know, if it was rocky or mountainous, may not be well suited for the farmers or the planters. You know, back then, everything was about planting crops, these big cash crops. So people would want to know what these surveyors were doing. So these men became very, very knowledgeable of the wildlife that were out there. That's also what they were hunting to live off of. And they were trading with the Native Americans, not just whiskey and gunpowder, but, you know, they were trading social problems. They were trading different types of philosophies of life. They were trading different survival skills, and they were networking amongst each other and building these relationships, sometimes good, sometimes bad, sometimes being chased for a long time until you come across a tribe that was more friendly to the crown, to the British. And you had various different types of Native American tribes that were out there who were, I guess you could say, loyal to the French, and then another side that was loyal to the British. The British and French were constantly making treaties with the Native Americans, who were honestly on their side, but also fighting against themselves. And the Iroquois Confederacy was one of the biggest ones that was there. And you had a multitude of tribes that fell underneath the Iroquois Confederacy. So not every tribe liked each other. Not every tribe agreed with one another. And not every tribe recognized each other as the, I guess you could say, more affluent tribe to use as guides. So there was always a little bit of twists and turns in there. And the life of being a surveyor and a frontiersman, man, that is a challenging, interesting life. So I thought you would really like to hear about that. Washington goes to war and changes history. And when I say Washington changed history, this man did something he never thought he was going to do. And we're gonna continue to break this down, and it gets exhausting. But when you really look at some of the things that Washington did, through ambition and being, very naive and very ignorant at a young age, it led to one of the most successful campaigns against an established empire in human history, which was the American Revolt, the Revolution. So real quick from, whitehouse.gov. Probably one of the only factual things from the whitehouse.gov that's on here is George Washington. I'd like to read you a little bit about him. On April 30th, 1789, George Washington, standing on the balcony of Federal Hall on Wall Street in New York, took his oath of office as the first president of the United States. He was quoted saying, "As the first of everything, in our situation will serve to establish a precedent." He wrote James Madison, "It is devoutly wished on my part that these precedents may be fixed on true principles." Isn't that interesting? On true principles, the thing that most of the people who run this country have completely forgot. Now, he pursued two intertwined interests between military arts and Western expansion. And some of this is going to go over what I've already read. But at 16, he helped survey the Shenandoah lands for Thomas Lord Fairfax. He was commissioned as a lieutenant colonel in 1754. He fought the first skirmishes of what grew into the French and Indian War. We're going to talk about that a lot. The next year, as an aide to General Edward Braddock, he escaped injury, although four bullets ripped his coat and two horses were shot from underneath him. This skirmish with the French, and I'm not reading this, I'm just telling you this from my knowledge. The skirmish with the French ended up becoming the real pivotal moment in his career where he finally had the ability to lead men in combat and to finally take command. After Braddock was mortally wounded, he was shot repeatedly within the stomach. And Braddock said, "I can't do this anymore. I can't lead these men." All the other officers, because there were over 60 officers that were killed during this engagement, the targeting of officers, which back then in the gentleman style wars, was not very nice to do. And this man, Washington, led the retreat, but successfully led the retreat and was commended for it. Now, I want you to go to battlefield.org for a real accurate history, a real accurate historical representation of the British Army, because the British Army and the way George Washington originally fought, he originally tried to fight like the British did. And the British were one of these one of a kind style of fighting forces that were out there, and it just didn't work well within the American battlegrounds. They didn't have the luxury of these large open fields for these engagements, especially with the way the British would use engagements. And the British thought very lowly of the American colonials and how they fought. They didn't find it to be very gentleman-like. I'm going to read you real quick from battlefield.org. This is great stuff. The army that opposed American independence has its roots in the 17th century with the formation of the New Model Army as a permanent standing army during the English Civil War. In the century that followed, the size of the army grew and shrank depending on the circumstances, and by 1775 it numbered around 48,000 men. By European standards, the British Army was extremely small. The French maintained a force nearly four times larger, but many Britain did not see the need for such a large army. For one, there was a political resistance to maintaining a large army. Many British subjects looked back at the time the New Model Army was established and saw how a professional force could be used to oppress the people. In addition to the dangers it posed to liberty, a standing army was also extremely expensive to maintain during peacetime. As an island nation at the heart of a colonial empire, the Navy was vastly more important to maintaining British trade and projecting British power. The main role of the peacetime army was to guard the colonial frontiers and to maintain control over Ireland. Now, you can really get into this and read through it. It is terrific writing. That's battlefield.org. And basically what it compiles to is that the way the British thought army should be used, it made it simpler for the generals to have men lined up in these skirmisher lines. And these skirmisher lines, these small platoons, were led by very, very well-seasoned non-commissioned officers, your corporals and sergeants and so forth. And I could tell you as a prior Marine who was also a corporal, a non-commissioned officer, I really can kind of comprehend what they're trying to tell us here. And the way they would move these men back and forth, everything was about discipline and efficiency at arms. How quickly they can reload really came down to how calm they could put in the ball, put in the powder, ram it into the barrel, and shoulder the arms, and then fire. And the fire of accuracy was important at certain levels of distance of engagements, but having the steady hand and reloading on time in sequence was actually the most efficient part of the British military. Their discipline of just standing there and taking the bullets and not moving, not being routed, was probably one of the things that helped them grow as an empire and fight on the battlefield effectively. They would just march into carnage. They would lower their rifles and fire, reload, repeat, next volley comes and fire, and they would just keep coming at you with overwhelming superior firepower and superior force of numbers until you eventually just, you had to run, you were routed by them because they would eventually give the word to charge, or the cavalry, the dragoons, would ride in and they would flank the enemy from either the left or right. It's sort of like an L ambush style. Very interesting military facts. So getting back to this, Unlike the formal training he received in surveying, which was complemented by his practical experience in the field, because George Washington was a very successful surveyor, he did not have a formal training in war. In fact, he had a blunderous and dismal start to becoming a professional soldier. The only time Washington left the mainland, and we're gonna segue from this real quick because I want to touch on something that I cornered a little bit last week on epidemics. The only time Washington left the mainland of North America was to accompany his older half-brother Lawrence to the island of Barbados. During this voyage in November 1751, young Washington contracted the deadly disease smallpox. After making a full recovery, Washington became forever immune to smallpox, but this immunity would prove to be a crucial blessing to George during the American Revolution at a time when the epidemic of smallpox was rampaging throughout the 13 colonies and throughout his military ranks. So, once again, the epidemics and pandemics have always plagued us and will always continue to plague us, especially in the middle of a war. So remember this, my post-apocalyptic friends. When wartime comes, so do disease and infections. Keep plenty of Band-Aids and antiseptics out there and clean clothes and the ability to wash yourself. Because the last thing you want to do is fall victim to some deadly disease during the middle of a crisis for your nation or for your own survival. So I just wanted to hit that real quick. In 1754, 23-year-old Major Washington led a surprise attack on a small French military unit. Major Washington had unknowingly attacked a French emissary who was carrying documents for peace and a declaration of boundaries to be established between the British Empire that was moving westward through the Ohio Valley and the French and Canadians who were moving southward and following a fur trade route. Now, these two would clash here and there, and along these rivers, along the Ohio Valley, the French would set up small establishments, small settlements that would help to not only, I guess you could say, create a sector of where they would be located, but it was also a place for establishing the trade routes for the fur collectors that the French Empire was using. And they wanted to protect their trade routes, but at the same time, they were having incursions from Native American tribes that were attacking them, and from the British and the colonials. So, you know, the French, of course, did not care where the British were. This was contested territory within the Ohio Valley because the British had not claimed it, and the French, more or less, had claimed it first. So, there's a little bit of knowledge for you. And this is really interesting. Washington's surprise attack on the French would lead to the beginnings of the French and Indian Wars that lasted for 7 years, also known as the period of the 7 Years' War. And a quick note, many historians believe the French and Indian Wars were actually the originators of the need for the American Revolution. The British war with the French showed the difference in goals between the Crown and the American colonies. The French and Indian War exposed and exasperated the development and the fundamental differences, both culturally and socially, between the British and Americans. After the death of Washington's older half-brother Lawrence, who served as a military adjutant for Virginia, the role of adjutant was given to an almost 21-year-old Washington, whom had no military experience at all. So let me just break this down real quick and make my mark. Back in the 1700s, with the way the colonies were set up, the governor would assign a military adjutant. And this military adjutant would be the one who would go back and forth between the governor of the colony and the British government, more so along the lines of the military. The House of Burgesses did not approve of Lord Dinwiddie, who was the governor of Virginia. And since they disapproved of each other very much, during a time of need and necessity because of the French incursion through the Ohio Valley and the British expansion westward, which was more or less the Virginia expansion westward, the governor decided to appoint Washington. Now, the way the appointments were, because you may be saying, well, why would they appoint a almost 21-year-old who was just a surveyor? He didn't go to a military academy. He had no formal education. He had never been in combat before. So why would he get it? Well, the way they used to do it back in the 1700s is that these commissions to be in the military as an adjutant within the colonies, if the person who was the adjutant died, the commission would typically be passed to somebody within the family. And Washington was a very ambitious young man. He really wanted to be in the military. He wanted to be in the British military. He wanted to impress and impress upon the governor that he really could do this and that he was the best appointment for it, and he won him over. Now, although although he was very confident and ambitious as a young man, George Washington lacked the formal British military training and the combat experience. And this led to, once again, his first blunderous involvement with the French emissaries. The problem with that was that the Iroquois Confederacy, whom the British were using as scouts and as allies, well, they had squabbles amongst all the various tribes that were under it, but one of them that was the one that was attached to George Washington after he was sent out to investigate these incursions from the French into the Ohio Valley had a little bit of a beef with the French. He went and told the French, this half-king, and that's the way the Iroquois were calling all these lesser tribes, this one Native American leader, and the only thing I can ever find is that he was just called the half-king, led Washington to the French, and Washington came with papers from Lord Dinwiddie, the governor, with letters saying, hey, Ohio Valley is ours. We're exploring it. You need to cease and desist. You need to move your people and your settlement. Stop the trade route. You're going to cause a war if you don't. And he went to not one, not two, but three different forts to try and hand these letters off to the French. And the first two completely ignored them. And not only that, but the half-king, the Native American who accompanied him, also was trying to give him a war pelt in semblance of, you know, hey, we should be getting along with each other. And, you know, please listen to this man. And that war pelt was denied twice. Well, that was a great disrespect to the Native Americans. And so not only was the half-king disrespected twice during the incident with George Washington, he was also disrespected previously when he told the French to leave their land. Now, this led, and historians may debate this, but this led to a little bit of a carnage that happened later, where more or less the half-king had tricked George Washington into attacking a small French settlement where these French emissaries were. And during the same time, during this brazen attack, the surprise attack, one of the emissaries for the French were also trying to call for parley and were trying to hand him papers as well. So A little bit of miscommunication. They were both trying to do the same thing. Washington was led astray a little bit. He was very ambitious, wanted his military career to look very good, and thought that an attack on the French would be a good way to concrete that into his superiors' minds. And he ended up making such a mistake that it caused the French and Indian War, which eventually led to the American Revolutionary War. Oh, what little things little mistakes can do. Now, Washington's lack of combat experience and his naive perception of being a military leader caused him to become a more disciplined soldier in the future, and he would reflect a lot on his past and a lot of the different military incursions that he himself had been on and all the different political missions that he had been on. And this would help to shape a more confident and a sharper-minded Washington. And this man that eventually was a laughingstock to the generals and to the officers of the British ranks ended up becoming one of their absolute worst nightmares. The war on important event in Washington's development. The war was a very important event. And his later decisions and actions were influenced by his intensive involvement in the French and Indian War. Washington's war experiences not only taught him valuable lessons, but he learned lessons about how to command properly. And he learned lessons about politics that he originally didn't have. They also caused him to re-example his professional and personal goals. And the war provided Washington with valuable military experience and shaped his perceptions of the relationships between the colonials and the British. The British Army did not think well of the colonials. They thought of them as country bumpkins, as very low on the totem pole. They were not highly intelligent. They were not highly trained. They didn't have formal education like all their esteemed majesties of the British Empire. And because of that, even the higher-ranking military officers within the colonies that were appointed by the governors, who the governors are given, granted, they're given power by the king, but they're still only colonists. They're not exactly the British military. So whenever someone would come around from the British military, even the highest-ranking colonial officer fell under them as a subordinate. So, Washington at times as a lieutenant colonel fell underneath a lieutenant and had to do what they said. So, this would cause a lot of friction back and forth between the militaries. The lieutenant of Virginia, Robert Dinwiddie, complained excessively to the British government to stop French and Canadian incursions into the Ohio Valley, an area Governor Dinwiddie had a lot of financial investments in that he considered to be threatened by the southern expansion of the French fur trade route and the construction of French settlements along the future expansion westward into the Ohio Valley was very unsettling to him, and he just wanted it stopped and he wanted them removed. Now, under the Privy Council, the power was given from King George from the British government to the colonial governors to resist French incursions in America by the means of military force. And Governor Dinwiddie, in 1753, sent a young major who was in charge of a small colonial force of men to investigate French incursions as his own emissary. That young man was George Washington. And George Washington lit the fuse for a world war back whenever he fought France in Canada. Now, I would implore you to really do your research on this. Some websites I'm going to give you are battlefields.org, thehistorychannel.com, history.com. That's actually a pretty good one. Another one, which is probably one of the best ones, is MountVernon.org. MountVernon.org. And lastly, the Boston Tea Party ship.com. These are some of the things I would love for you to check out. Learn your history, learn the American history. We have just touched the surface of what this means to be an American and what led to it, what eventually led to the Lexington Concord event, what eventually led to the defeat of Lord Cornwallis in New York. Next week, we're going to get into a lot of this. I was really going to get into stuff about philosophers and all their philosophizings, but I'm going to back that up because I think that the American Revolution is a great way to take you into a new year where we need to get back, possibly, to a new revolution in this country, a revolution of freedom. So I'm going to give you a reminder of what the first one was. I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Thank you for listening. I'm out. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.